You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Citizen Spike by K. Austin Collins. The difficulty of some of Lee's recent work is that his storytelling can take forms that grate against our sense of what we, the politically aware public, feel we need. Lee's writing partner Kevin Wilmot says that's part of the point. This is the challenge that audiences, both black and white audiences, have to grapple with. There's truth to be had there. Which isn't the same as saying we have to accept the movie on its director's terms, though many of us will. At Cannes this year, Black Klansman won the Grand Prix, effectively second place. Director Ava DuVernay, a confessed lifelong fan of Lee's work, was on the jury, and she told me its members were more or less on the same page about the movie. It's the first film by an auteur of the Trump era, she says, a filmmaker directing their camera right on the crosshairs of this moment in a way that's very specific. Next, photos. Lee promoting his first film, She's Gotta Have It, 1986. And Adam Driver and John David Washington in Lee's latest, the Cannes Grand Prix winner, Black Klansman. The movie garnered positive notices in the press, though words like uneven and mess came up their fair share. At least one black American critic, Miriam Bale, walked away dismayed. The film seems one note and superficial, she wrote for W Magazine, like a Saturday Night Live sketch, or more accurately, like something from Key and Peele. Cannes was, for her, notable for having so few black critics in attendance, and this, she suggests, might explain the generally upbeat tenor of the reviews. This debate is likely to play out again when the film is released in the States. Lee opens the movie with that famous wide shot from Gone with the Wind, where an astonished, terrified Scarlett O'Hara lumbers into a sea of Confederate casualties. It closes just as aggressively, seamlessly transitioning into footage from Charlottesville, tiki torch-filled images that have already seeped deep into the public consciousness. Some will find this gauche at best. We knew that would be the key, that if we connect this period film to today, we would have a good chance for it doing well, Lee says. The ending is an explicit attempt to accomplish that and then some. Does it overplay its hand? Depends on whom and when you ask. His more provocative movies, Lee reminds me optimistically, aren't usually appreciated in their time. Sometimes films don't click. Audiences don't get it right away, he says. People did not get Bamboozled. They didn't get it. They get it now. As for Black Klansman's prospects, Lee doesn't seem worried. I ask if he thinks the movie will find the audience it deserves in the U.S. I'm not going to jinx anything, he says. I'm not messing with the cinema gods. I'm hoping for the best, and that's my answer. Now, from James Wolcott comes this, the Hollywood pity party. There's conservatives in them thar hills, low in numbers, but loud in Greek chorus. Photo illustration by Matt Dorfman, which shows a scene take board with an elephant sitting, its trunk holding up the cut bar. The hate on that hard-boiled conservatives cultivate against Hollywood is one of the few perennials of our fidgety time. It's like a persistent buzzsaw whining away in the background, a self-perpetuating grievance machine. Michael Medved's Hollywood vs. America, James Herson's Hollywood Nation, Laura Ingraham's Shut Up and Sing, Roger L. Simon's Turning Right at Hollywood and Vine, The Perils of Coming Out Conservative in Tinseltown. Nary a year goes by without a conservative anti-Hollywood screed or apostate memoir. Pundits and mouth-foaming bloggers deprived of book contracts can feast upon awards season, which eats up more of the calendar with each passing year. That annual scavenger hunt for evidence of how out of touch, pampered, elitist, George Clooney-loving Hollywood is with the breakfast crowd at Denny's. Whenever we seem to hit a lull in the hostilities, something newsy happens, such as ABC's cancellations of Roseanne Barr's sitcom earlier this year and Tim Allen's the year before, which revives old familiar refrains about how there ain't no place on the liberal plantation for an uppity conservative. Liberal plantations overlap the land to hear oppressed conservatives with Ivy League degrees and think tank affiliations tell it. The Democratic Party is a liberal plantation, keeping African American voters in a perpetual state of government handout dependency. The elite universities are liberal plantations, indoctrinating the susceptible young receptacles of yearning and learning into social justice warriors and prickly snowflakes. But Hollywood is the liberal plantation that throws off the most Klieg-like glamour and offers the highest fame recognition, making it the juiciest battlefield for the hearts and souls of citizen consumers. As the late Andrew Breitbart, irate founder of right-wing media site Breitbart News Network, was fond of saying, politics is downstream from culture. Breitbart sported a revolutionist beard and was prone to raging fits, but he was no John Brown taking arms against the Hollywood ramparts. HBO host and comic Bill Maher jibed about Breitbart. Oh, he hated Hollywood. Hated it. Mostly from his home in America's heartland, Brentwood. In an interview in 2009, Breitbart described conversations with major name actors who feared being forthright about their conservative convictions because of the retribution that might follow. He sought to liberate his brother and sister conservatives in the entertainment industry from having to creep around in the shadows and conduct their politics in Morse code blinks for fear of being detected, tagged, and brutally denied valet parking. He wanted to change the environment so that conservative talents could be as free and open to affirm their value system as those phonies on the left. It would appear that even this modest goal failed. Here we are, 6 years after Breitbart prematurely cashed in his chips at the age of 43, cause congestive heart failure, and Hollywood conservatives still act as if prison searchlights are prowling the studio parking lot. A bigger bunch of crybabies you've seldom heard in your life. Even before his sitcom Last Man Standing was dropped by ABC after 6 seasons, Tim Allen chortlingly compared the fear atmosphere for conservatives, such as himself, to the Nazi era. You get beat up if you don't believe what everybody believes. This is like 30s Germany, he told host Jimmy Kimmel. Historians might note that getting beat up in 30s Germany meant actual kicks and punches and getting dragged through the streets, not having a rough time on social media or receiving frowns in the craft services line. Like many a conservative who professes allegiance to the dungaree-clad ideal of traditional manhood, which, in Allen's previous series, Home Improvement, translated as being handy with power tools, he played the victim card after Last Man Standing was axed, claiming that his character, Mike Baxter, was too much realness for the libs to handle. "There's nothing more dangerous to me, especially in this climate, than a funny, likable conservative." Last Man Standing was soon picked up for season 7 by Fox, which presumably has a larger appetite for danger. As for the runamuck Roseanne Barr, her self-titled sitcom fell to the terrible swift sword of ABC after she let fly on her Twitter feed an unwholesome stream on the best of days, a jibe against former Obama White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett, that managed to be racist and nutso in one economical capsule. Uproar, muddled explanations from Barr, stout defenses from her fans, in short, the usual social media psychodrama, only supersized, and ABC saw only Cirrus ahead. It wasn't Barr's incoherent bombast that got her bounced. It wasn't even her racist tweet. A genuinely sincere apology might have quelled the furor, but the fact that she was incontinent in her lashing out. It turned out, however, that the network wasn't canceling Roseanne the series so much as Roseanne herself. A spin-off series titled The Conners was quickly assembled that would reunite the cast minus its cranky matriarch. Other conservatives kindled by liberal Hollywood groupthink include veteran actor James Woods, fired by his agent on July 4th, giving all of us a special holiday treat. Actress Stacey Dash, whose sole claim to showbiz fame was her supporting role in Clueless. "There goes my social life, from Clueless to conservative," her literary equivalent, the late R. Lee Ermey, best known as the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket, Antonio Sabato Jr., whose screen presence eludes me, maybe Scott Bio, the illustrious star of Charles in Charge, and, that's about it. That's not much of a blacklist. And put that up against the roster of uncloseted Republicans who have carved out solid ongoing careers in the Sodom and Gomorrah of royalties and residuals, such as John Voight, creaking through the entire run of Showtime's Ray Donovan, Kelsey Grammer, who has clocked as many TV series as he has failed marriages, now starring in a new movie, Proven Innocent, for Fox, and Tom Selleck, whose family cop drama, Blue Bloods, will be running in syndicated reruns long after his mustache starts to droop. Clint Eastwood, he's done. Okay, and it says something about Hollywood's forbearance that Mel Gibson has been able to mount a directorial comeback with Hacksaw Ridge and a supporting role in the family-friendly hit Daddy's Home 2 after a sporadic series of racist, anti-Semitic, violence-threatening outbursts that separately or in toto could have been career killers. He was a man wrestling with demons who made a convincing show of contrition. There's nothing Hollywood loves more than an arc of redemption. However, a few high-profile conservatives prospering in the super-woke entertainment field will never satisfy those who wish to overthrow the hegemony of liberal pop culture with its moral sloth, smug secular humanism on stilts, denigration of God and country, villainization of corporate capitalism, and Oprah deification. Andrew Breitbart once lamented that donors put their money behind candidates and crucial races instead of investing in a movie studio or original TV programming of their own, building an infrastructure that would produce and distribute real, honest, made-in-America, traditional-values-flag-saluting entertainment, just like Mama used to bake. It was never a plausible battle plan. Billionaires with a Koch brothers agenda prefer to dangle judges, lobbyists, and legislators from their keychains, and the talent pool of creative conservatives isn't deep enough to quench a sparrow. It isn't in their best interest to compete in the creative marketplace, where they'd have to show their mettle instead of crabbing that Hollywood is run by a social justice junta avenging the defeat of Queen Hillary. The recurrent wish for a return to the patriotic certitudes and moral hygiene of post-war Hollywood is an indulgence in white nostalgia, which Donald Trump has tapped into for his own nihilistic destructive ends, assisted by Russian troll farms and bots and allied disruptors. It is in conservatives' best interest that Hollywood remain perceived as a liberal plantation with an endless red carpet. It offers a vital and valuable evergreen source of fodder for their flapping gums, especially now that the hashtag MeToo movement has exposed some very high-profile liberal producers and actors as serial harassers, predators, and night-crawling creepazoids. So much fun and schadenfreude to be had from the tarnished luster of Hollywood hypocrisy, so many mea culpas to harvest. Conservative Hollywood haters may be parasites, unable to survive without the host body, but they're happy parasites. Anyway, it beats trying to breathe new life into Scott Baio's career.
Thank you.
Power Plays by Joe Pompeo. Too Big to Fail, the battle for 21st Century Fox has become a grim metaphor for the future of media. Opening illustration by Oliver Monday. The bromance between Rupert Murdoch and Bob Iger has left Brian Roberts on the outs. Murdoch and Iger are shown close together with hearts and arrows drawn around them in red, while Brian Roberts is in the background looking on disapprovingly. On the afternoon of June 12th, Brian Roberts was sitting in a colleague's office on the 52nd floor of the Comcast Tower in downtown Philadelphia, eagerly awaiting the news that would significantly impact the company his family had run for a half century. For decades, the Roberts clan had steadily moved from the periphery of the media universe to its white-hot center. First, through a series of prescient telecommunication deals, and later through the acquisition of NBC Universal, a purchase that gave Comcast everything a modern media conglomerate could conceivably want. A film studio, a premium Big Four network, a thriving cable division, a trusted news business, and the pipes to control it all. By the dawn of the decade, the Philadelphia media behemoth was competing with flashier companies on the coast, like Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox, Jeff Bukes's Time Warner, and Bob Iger's Disney. On this balmy late spring afternoon, however, Roberts had reason to believe that his company's fortune, despite its nearly $150 billion market capitalization, was becoming increasingly vulnerable. All the ascendant media behemoths of the 90s and aughts, after all, seemed to pale in comparison to the upstarts emerging from the West Coast. Last year, Facebook and Amazon saw their market valuations sail past $500 billion, a milestone that put them alongside Alphabet, Apple, and Microsoft, some of the world's richest organizations. This spring, Netflix briefly became the world's most valuable media company. The era of scale had been supplanted by one of superscale, a leitmotif that now rendered the establishment players fearful. 10 years ago, companies like Viacom and Fox and Time Warner were considered giants of the entertainment industry and giants of American culture. One long-serving media executive recently lamented to me, "Now, they're pawns consumed by much larger, more formidable businesses that see entertainment as an essential cog." In order to compete against new media, traditional media companies were combining as never before. And on June 12th, Roberts and the rest of the media world were fixated on the E. Barrett Prettyman United States Courthouse in Washington, D.C., where Judge Richard Leon was due to render a verdict in AT&T's 8-month battle with the Department of Justice to purchase Time Warner for $85 billion. Roberts knew that Leon's ruling was going to set the tone for an array of future mergers hanging in the balance, not least of all Disney's plan to bite off a chunk, a huge chunk, of 21st Century Fox for $52.4 billion, a deal that Comcast wanted for itself. Roberts, who is 59, has a genial corporate manner that belies a competitive ferocity. As he awaited the verdict, he was preparing to outbid Iger by some $12 billion. It was a typical display of media swordsmanship, sure. But it also suggested a level of urgency. With 21st Century Fox off the table, not only would Roberts watch a competitor suddenly emerge triumphant, but any future media acquisitions on his part were more likely to look like a roll-up of lesser assets. Not long after 4 p.m., as reporters raced out of the courtroom to tweet that Leon had approved the deal, Roberts saw the verdict flash across a screen tuned to CNBC. He bounded out of his CFO's office to huddle with other Comcast executives down the hall. It was showtime. The following morning, they boarded a train to New York, where Comcast announced its unsolicited offer for the Fox film studio, National Geographic Channel, FX, 30% of Hulu, and an array of foreign broadcast assets for $65 billion in cash. In the media business, this past year has been something like the summer of 68, a tumultuous, chaotic collision of personalities and companies. It has felt like the vanishing of one world order, where consumers were reliant on a cable provider, and the emergence of a brave new one where everything is accessed on the phone, and traditional players must join forces in a fight for survival against incipient challengers. This dynamic explains why Iger would later raise Disney's bid to $71 billion in a cash and stock offer. Even world-weary media analysts were predicting that the auction could potentially climb as high as $90 billion before Comcast stood down. The Roberts-Iger showdown and AT&T-Time Warner saga, now under appeal by the DOJ, have played out amid similarly epic corporate convulsions. The battle between Les Moonves and Shari Redstone over the fate of CBS and Viacom, Sinclair Broadcast Group's controversial plan to buy Tribune Media, a billionaire doctor and philanthropist $500 million bid to save the Los Angeles Times, and Meredith Corporation's consumption of Time Inc., followed by a once unfathomable yard sale for the one-time magazine stalwart's most historic properties. Meanwhile, Netflix and Amazon each announced it would be spending billions on original content. You could argue they've pulled off in just a few years a consolidation of influence that the Roberts family took 5 decades to achieve. One of the defining characteristics of the media business, however, is that many of the largest players are essentially family-run enterprises, and so the deal logic can be nuanced. A June 21st Wall Street Journal feature portrayed Murdoch and Iger as kindred moguls, happy to be working together, while casting Roberts, who was famously rebuffed by Disney when Comcast made a surprise $54 billion offer for the company in 2004, as a snake in the grass. He's aggressive, and he's focused, and he's smart, someone who knows Roberts well countered, but he's not a little shit. At the same time that Roberts was gunning for 21st Century Fox, Comcast also made an offer to acquire Sky, the European pay TV provider. Its competitor? Naturally, 21st Century Fox. Perhaps more crucially, Murdoch has found a way to salvage his entertainment portfolio while also resolving once and for all the long-speculated succession of his dynasty among heirs who aren't always on the same page with each other regarding company strategy. Some people who know the Murdochs well told me that Lachlan and James Murdoch, co-executive chairman and CEO respectively, could have ended up splitting 21st Century Fox apart after the elder Murdoch was out of the picture. And so it was better for the aging mogul to do it himself, especially when the condition was ripe. Now, if all goes according to plan, Murdoch keeps the stuff he most cherishes, namely Fox News, which will be the profit center of a future company tentatively referred to as New Fox. In addition to his far-reaching global newspaper empire, now News Corp, Lachlan gets the crown, and with it the responsibility of plotting a course for his father's much-diminished pirate fleet. While James, increasingly nauseated by the propagandist stench of the Fox News primetime lineup, gets to leave the nest and try something new, whatever that may be. The market timing is good. He's the ultimate pragmatist, said one shareholder who knows the Murdochs, referring to its patriarch. It's a perfect solution, and one that's maximally compensated. And it was clearly important to Murdoch. According to people with direct knowledge of the deal, Murdoch didn't loop in his kids until about a month after his initial conversation with Iger. The upside for Comcast is that it won't become saddled with the debt required to obtain those properties. The downside, as Rich Greenfield, the Wall Street media analyst, put it, is that in terms of comparable acquisition targets, there's no fallback. There's no plan B. The remaining targets, according to a prominent media executive I spoke with, are underwhelming, or, as he put it, a dog's breakfast of media leftovers. A lot of shitty deals. Lionsgate, MGM, Sony, Viacom, CBS, Discovery, AMC. It's not the most appetizing menu. Summing up the frenzy, Axios recently floated the notion of a future Disney-Comcast merger. The technology giants, for their part, seem unthreatened. The joke on all these old white guys, notes another veteran media executive, is that they're kind of fighting over old white guy-created assets, and technology is laughing at them on the sidelines. It's not like they're quibbling over scraps. These aren't like forgotten assets. But they're not the future. Uncanny Valley by Susan Fowler. What have we done? Silicon Valley engineers fear the gig economy they created will soon displace us all. Illustrations by Ben Wiseman. Opening illustration shows a Pac-Man scene with Pac-Man gobbling up people. In the heart of San Francisco, the gig economy reigns supreme. Walk into a grocery store, and a large number of shoppers you see are independent contractors for grocery delivery startup Instacart. Step outside, and cars with black and white Uber stickers or flashing Lyft dashboard lights are sitting, hazards on, blocking the bike lane as they wait for passengers. Cyclists zigzag around the cars, many hauling bags branded with various logos, Caviar, Postmates, Uber Eats, as they deliver food to customers around the city. You can stand on a street corner and count the number of gig economy workers walking by, as I often do. Sometimes it's two out of every 10. On some corners, like the one near the Whole Foods on 4th and Harrison, I've counted 8 out of every 10. The gig economy ecosystem was supposed to represent the promised land, striking a harmonious egalitarian balance between supply and demand. Consumers could offload the drudgery of commuting or grocery shopping, while workers were set free from the man. "Set your own schedule," touts the Uber driver website. "Be your own boss," tempts Lyft. "Make an impact on people's lives," lures Instacart. These companies have been wildly successful. Uber, perhaps the most notorious, is also the most valuable startup in the U.S., reportedly worth $72 billion. Lyft is valued at $11 billion, and grocery delivery startup Instacart is valued at just over $4 billion. In recent months, however, a spate of lawsuits has highlighted an alarming byproduct of the gig economy, a class of workers who aren't protected by labor laws or eligible for benefits provided to the rest of the nation's workforce. Evident even to those outside the bubble of Silicon Valley. A July report commissioned by the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission found that 85% of New York City's Uber, Lyft, Juno, and Via drivers earn less than $17.22 an hour. When the California Supreme Court ruled in May that delivery company Dynamex must treat its gig workers like full-time employees, Eve Wagner, an attorney who specializes in employment litigation, predicted to Wired the number of employment lawsuits is going to explode. Of course, the threads of this disillusionment are woven into the very structure that has made these startups so successful. A few weeks into my tenure at Uber, where I started as a software developer just a year after graduating from college, still blindly convinced that I could make the world a better place, a coworker sat down next to my desk. "There's something you need to know," she said in a low voice, "and I don't want you to forget it. When you're writing code, you need to think of the drivers. Never forget that these are real people who have no benefits, who have to live in this city, who depend on us to write responsible code. Remember that." I didn't understand what she meant until several weeks later, when I overheard two other engineers in the cafeteria discussing driver bonuses. Specifically, ways to manipulate bonuses so that drivers could be tricked into working longer hours. Laughing, they compared the drivers to animals. You need to dangle the carrot right in front of their face. Shortly thereafter, a wave of price cuts hit drivers in the Bay Area. When I talked to the drivers, they described how Uber kept fares in a perfectly engineered sweet spot, just high enough for them to justify driving, but just low enough that not much more than their gas and maintenance expenses were covered. Those of us on the front lines of the gig economy were the first to spot and expose its flaws. 2 months after leaving Uber, I wrote a highly publicized account of my time there, describing the company's toxic work environment in detail. Now, as Silicon Valley struggles to come to terms with its corrosive underpinnings, a new vein of disquiet has wormed its way into the Slack chats and happy hour outings of low-level rank-and-file engineers, spurred by a question that seems to drown out everything else. What have we done? It's a question that I, too, have been forced to grapple with, as I notice how my job as a software engineer has changed the nature of work in general, and not necessarily for the better. Gig economy platforms, as they're called, take their inspiration from software engineering, where the goal is to create modular, scalable software applications. To do this, engineers build small pieces of code that run concurrently, dividing a task into ever smaller pieces to conquer it more efficiently. Startups function in a similar way. Tasks that used to make up a single job are broken down into the smallest possible code pieces, then partitioned so those pieces can be accomplished in parallel. It's been a successful approach for startups for the same reason it's a successful approach to writing code. It is perfectly, beautifully efficient. Across so-called platforms, there are no individuals, no bosses delegating tasks. Instead, various algorithms run on the platform, matching consumers with workers, riders with the nearest driver, and hungry customers with delivery people, telling them where to go, what to do, and how to do it. Constant needs and their quick solutions all hummingly perpetually aligned. By now, it's clear that these companies represent more than a trend. Though it's difficult to accurately determine the size of the gig economy, estimates range from 0.7 to 34% of the national workforce. The number grows with each new startup that figures out how to break down another basic task. There's a relatively low risk associated with launching gig economy companies, startups that can engage in a kind of contract arbitrage because they aren't bearing the corporate or societal cost, even as they reap fractional or full-time value from workers, explains Seattle-based tech journalist Glenn Fleischman. Thanks to this buffer, they're almost guaranteed to multiply. As the gig economy grows, so too does the danger of the engineers in attempting to build the most efficient systems will chop and dice jobs into pieces so dehumanized that our legal system will no longer recognize them. And along with this comes an even more sinister possibility, jobs that would and should be recognizable, especially supervisory and management positions, will disappear altogether. If a software engineer can write a set of programs that breaks a job into smaller increments and can follow it up with an algorithm that fills in as the supervisor, then the position itself can be programmed to redundancy. A few months ago, a lunchtime conversation with several friends turned to the subject of the gig economy. We began to enumerate the potential causes of worker displacement, things like artificial intelligence and robots, which are fast becoming a reality, expanding the purview of companies such as Google and Amazon. The displacement is happening right under our noses, said a woman sitting next to me, another former engineer. Not in the future. It's happening now. What can we do about it? Someone asked. Another woman replied that the only way forward was for gig economy workers to unionize, and the table broke out into serious debate. Yet even as we roundly condemned the tech world's treatment of a vulnerable new class of worker, we knew the stakes were much higher, high enough to alter the future of work itself, to the detriment of all but a select few. Most people, I said, interrupting the hubbub, don't even see the problem unless they're on the inside. Everyone nodded. The risk, we agreed, is that the gig economy will become the only economy, swallowing up entire groups of employees who hold full-time jobs, and that it will eventually displace us all. The bigger risk, however, is that the only people who understand the looming threat are the ones enabling it. End Family Fire. 8 kids a day are accidentally killed or injured by family fire. Family fire is a shooting involving an improperly stored gun, often found in the home. For more information, contact endfamilyfire.org. A message from the Ad Council. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.